But that's where Jimmy used to go. He adored the people there. Because they were full of temperament. And I'll tell you, was a typical member of it. That man was in Syria afterwards. Spears, yes. Exactly. You can see the sort of thing. I should think Amory might have been in it. Might have been. Halifax would not. And there were certainly no socialists or anything of that sort. Liberals, yes. Like Jimmy himself. Don't know who they were, but it was a smart club of Duff Cooper, certainly. So you see the kind of thing. Tremendous rows. They used to get drunk. Scenes occurred. Rough draft, they used to call it and so on. Jacob is a member now. Now it's quite different. Roy Jenkins, Lord Goodman. I mean, it's... I refuse to become a member. It's no good to me. I don't like political clubs, which this was. Now, what about Jimmy? Yes, the country houses. 42. That is because when I was in Washington in 1942, I met, both in Washington and later in New York, in the information office, which I had some business, a man called Ronald Tree. Tree was the junior minister during the war, whom I knew very, very well. He was a very rich grandson of Marshall Field on his mother's side, and son of Judge Tree of Chicago on his father's side. He was married the niece of Lady Astor, and he bought a country house called Ditchley. It's exactly where he lived, precisely. And he was with Eden, he was anti-appeasement, he was a very honorable man, totally honest, extremely stupid, perfectly decent, large, fat, red-faced, sort of gentleman, pure American by birth. He went to Winchester and Columbia. That's where he went. Yes, but he was a millionaire. And he stuck to Eden and so on, and Macmillan and all that. And he was number two in the Ministry of Information. Or number three. I think Harold Nicholson was number two. Duff Cooper was the minister. By that time, Brendan Bracken. Well, then, 42. Brendan Bracken, number two, I think was no longer Harold Nicholson. Anyway, he was a parliamentary secretary or something like that. He was an MP.
Walton.
Yes.
Somebody who became then afterwards a cabinet minister in the later Churchill.
Not Walton.
But not Walton.
Walton was the Minister of Food.
And not Kilmore?
Certainly not.
No. So
Kilmore was a lawyer. Always. Kilmore was maybe the Attorney General. Could well be. But not that. The Minister was Bracken.
Yes.
The head of the ministry was Cyril Radcliffe, Harold Nicholson, number two, in 1940. But I don't think he was under Bracken. Under Duff Cooper, he certainly was. Not sure whether he stayed. Maybe he still was. Maybe, could be. Anyway, Ronnie Tree was the parliamentary secretary or something of that ministry. Being American, he used to come to America in order to get Americans to help him. He came to America in 41. That's where I met him. On the very day when, or at least I met him on the very day when Hess flew to England, I remember. And he thought that it was a tremendous event and probably the end of the war or something. But anyway, he was not very intelligent, but loyal, devoted, energetic, decent, everything and so on. But Member of Parliament for Market Harborough, defeated in 1945 during the Labour landslide, he says, by communists. Number of communists in Market Harborough, which is the most rural district imaginable, can't be very great. Well, I got on with him, I met him, and I had long talks with him, and he invited me to Ditchley. Now, literally during the war, but the house which was not rationed. He had had enough timber for the use and enough food, because Winston used to go there every fortnight to stay.
But that was the place of the decoding of the Enigma. I mean,
No.
That was not the key.
No. What's the name?
Bletchley, certainly.
No, Dutch's house near Oxford. All these conferences in Egypt. We constantly have anti-Israeli stuff going on. Yeah. But it's about 20 minutes walk, so it's in Woodstock.
Yes, I know.
Yes, you see. And that was his country house. His wife, as I told you, was a niece of Lady Aston, Winston liked. And Winston used to spend weekends there. For the kind of trekkers. Trekkers are too dangerous. You see? So he used to, and then the tree was more or less compelled to invite whoever Churchill wanted. When I went, Churchill wasn't there, but Duff Cooper was, and Brendan Bracken was, and all kinds of other people were. And he made friends with me, and I began going to, when I was in England, on leave. I was asked to Ditchley twice. There I met a certain number of what might be called the governing class. And when I came back in 44, these persons asked me to lunch and dinner. And then after 1945, when I came to Oxford, I used to go regularly. Ditchley, they became, made friends with me, the Arlene independently, and so on, you see. And there I used to meet all kinds of people. And his son married the daughter of the Duke of Devonshire, and that was his kind of company, you see. And then he divorced his wife and married an American lady who was called Marietta, she was in Office Gerald. She was a very high-minded American sort of Democrat still there, who was a great friend of Mrs. Roosevelt. She was a kind of human rights ambassador of the United Nations. She's his widow. He finally died. And she's a hostess in New York. Her brother was governor of Massachusetts. Her father was a bishop.
And it's Fitzgerald?
No, her husband, her first husband. The original name was Peabody. The grandfather was the founder of Groton, which is a kind of Eton. And the son was a bishop of, I don't know what, New England somewhere. The brother was governor of Connecticut, of Massachusetts. Pretty stupid too, quite nice. Anyway, she comes to say, I know her very well, she comes to stay with us too. Right, that's why my social life. Then what was Lady Cunard on top of that? Then I was asked by Lady Colfax, who we had lunch parties every week, of at least 15 people, and who Winston didn't like, and every letter always ended, Winston may be there. Never was. Logically not impossible, but materially, socially impossible for him to be there. And that people always used to accumulate when used to meet people there and so on. So I became a salon visiting person until I married Aline, when it stopped. Absolutely. I didn't particularly enjoy it, but she didn't like it very much, and I was very bored with it. And then it didn't entirely stop, but more or less stopped. With the watch.
No,
it's all right, good. We have time. It's all right. I tell you the story of how I came to America in the first place. In 1940.
Instead of going to Russia?
Instead of going to Russia.
On the
with Burgess.
Yes.
I did only. Very good.
And during those periods that you had intensive contacts, or more frequent contacts with Weizmann, did you have conversation of a more general nature about Zionism, nationalism?
No, I don't think so. He was not at all interested in that kind of thing. When I had to write about him an article for the Jewish Encyclopedia, and I said he was not intellectual, Vera is extremely offended. And he wasn't. No. No, general ideas didn't preoccupy him at all. According to Crossman, he read Nietzsche, or maybe he did. Certainly none of that could be visible by the time I met him. No, certainly not. We talked simply about practical Zionism, a very concrete guy. What was happening? Who was for, who was against? What was going on? Politically, there's no doubt he was left of center. Left of center. The people he inclined towards, he quite liked Mapam people. And above all, and he liked the non-Gurion parts of Mapai, he was an old sort of populist. He liked Kibbutzim, he liked the young Dayan.
He liked, I'll tell you, he liked some
colonists.
And like in Mapai, in Mapai you had two main streams. The very activist one, Ben-Gurion, Tabenkin, and others, whom he didn't like. And Sprintzak, Kaplan.
Whom he did like.
He liked, they were more humanistic politically.
Exactly. He liked Sprintzak, he genuinely liked. Kaplan he certainly did business with.
Yes. And he was more moderate. And
obviously.
Sprintzak, and there was a third one, I don't remember now. Now.
Not Remes.
Not
Remes. No. And certainly not Berger. Not, what's the name? No, I mentioned earlier. The contact with the Labour Party.
Berlocher.
No.
Yes, but you.
He knew him. He knew him.
Berlocher was torn between Weizmann and Ben-Gurion.
I understand. And because Nehemiah was a great ally in the 30s.
Yes.
Until the baptism.
Yes. But I think that Nehemiah was disappointed with Weizmann even a little earlier because Weizmann didn't, he wanted to be elected to the executive.
I know he did. He used to call it the yeshiva.
Yes, and he was not.
And he used to talk the rabunim in Polish, Yiddish. The rabunim were the members of the executive. He despised them. Well, you see, he was so offensive about them that he could not have been elected. About Brodetsky, he called him ein fett null. It means a fat zero.
Yes.
Not very polite.
Yes.
And he said the same thing about the rest of them. Berlocher he had total contempt for. And he was very rude and very overbearing. Well, Weizmann genuinely liked him, but could do nothing for him.
Surely could not. I mean, to be elected to the executive, you needed the support of a party.
Somebody. Or votes of somebody's party.
I mean, Brodetsky was either way elected by the general.
Now, mind you, Mrs. Dugdale did become member of the executive. Literally.
Yeah.
Because they liked that. That is done, yes.
It was a gesture.
It was a gesture.
In 46,
yeah.
Now, in January 47, after Weizmann was so disappointed by the Congress, he thought of, I mean, Weizmann, I think he had in him, one of his weaknesses in 46, 47, 48, or 45 even, he wanted to repeat his successes of the late first of the...
Correct. Didn't work.
In international affairs?
Yes.
And in internal affairs. Now, in internal affairs, after this shock he had in the Congress, when he was not elected, he wrote the letters to you and to three or four other people. I can't remember, I think Nehemiah. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think Eilat. I think Goldman. And suggesting that you should establish a new faction that would be in opposition.
Did I get...
It is a repetition of what happened in 1905.
Did I get such a letter?
Yes. It was sent to me.
I have no recollection of it.
I shall...
I'm sure you're right. I have no recollection of it.
It's, in one day, you see the serpent.
I understand. I know. I mean, no, I understand. Ridiculous, no, no.
And it's not a hotel. And there was no following. I don't think there was, that I saw it live.
No. Nothing happened at all.
Maybe somebody replied. Maybe Goldman replied or something like that.
No, it was no good.
Very pathetic.
Very. We were very crushed by it, of course. And, he used to tell me stories of this sort. He told me once that he was arrested by a policeman in Moscow for staying the night, which he was not allowed to do, because it was outside the pale. He had no permission. And the policeman said, "What do you do?" He explained to him that he was part of a Jewish movement called the Zionists. The policeman didn't quite understand what the Zionists were, but he said, "If you're working for Jews, let me tell you, they'll kill you in the end. There is no doubt about it. In the end, they will kill you. This is as certain as anything can be." Weizmann said he was quite right. It's exactly what they did. That was a typical European story repeated. Of course.
Now,
he was very funny about Russia before 1914. He said, "You know, they're very strange people, the Russians. I remember a Russian sitting in a sort of tea shop, a table next to mine. Well, the Russian said, 'You know, I went to Paris. I went to a cafe. Next to me, a Jew. Waiter came. He ordered something. The waiter brought him a cup of coffee, a Jew. Then he said something else. The waiter appeared again. He was brought a newspaper, began reading it, a Jew." It was as if this is out of the world, like saying an elephant. You see, to sit in a cafe with Goyim and just behave like that, incredible.
Now, he certainly managed to charm certain kind of politicians.
Lord Salisbury told me, I think I may have put that in my lecture, that all politicians tried to avoid seeing him, because they always, in the end, found they gave something which they did not mean to give. They always got into trouble with their civil servants for doing it. And he, Salisbury, admired him very much.
Salisbury, you mean Cranbourne?
Cranbourne, yes, as he then was.
He was very decent.
Perfectly decent. Towards the end, when after two sergeants and all that, it became slightly less. He said to Eileen, when we came to dinner, we were at the same dinner party. He said, "He's a very, very Zionist." But he did make a speech. He has a comment after the Struma or the Patria, saying this would never happen again. No, all that. No, all Cecils were fundamentally pro-Zionist. He became somewhat shaken when they became too anti-British, which is quite natural. Until then, he was absolutely all right. Unlike Eden, you see, was anti-Semitic from the start. Now, yes, they liked him, but they were always a little frightened of seeing him. Halifax quite liked being met, quite liked seeing him.
How did he impress them? I mean, was it its natural character, or he was shrewd enough to employ charm tactics?
Neither. He appeared before them in a solemn manner. He did not crack jokes. He did not amuse them. No. He was the Jewish people incarnate. He came out of the Middle Ages. He was tall, he was solemn. And he spoke for the historic Jewish people. And they were terribly impressed. The Old Testament prophet. That was the role he played. He didn't charm them in the sense of sitting down with them and making jokes or asking.
He
didn't give his love to their wives. Didn't say, please remember me too. None of that. She tried that, but they didn't like her. You see? She said, lady, that's the definition. She said to me, I think Dr. Weitzman is a wonderful man. Mrs. Weitzman's a little bit tiresome, don't you think?
But I fully see what you mean.
He came out of the historical personage.
But even so, did he play this role deliberately or was it natural?
Don't know.
Because
you and I mean, when I met him, he was not like that. So what's the good? He obviously used to march into our rooms. There was no private intercourse. He didn't ask me to dinner. Or if he did, it was on very few occasions. He did not come and go to dinner with them. He saw them officially. Or maybe there were interviews. Maybe, I don't think any English statesman, Balfour, I can't tell you. But all these colonial office, foreign office people, he more or less saw formally. Because fundamentally, he did not like going. Of all going, the English were best. But I told you before, he was only happy with Yiddish-speaking Russian Jews. I mean, even I was a little bit too westernized for his taste. You see? What he liked was Shmuel Levine. He would have got on Goldman if he didn't despise him. He used to call him the brothel keeper, the faker, the usual name for him.
And he didn't like German Jews?
Not at all. But he got money from them. When it was necessary, he made himself agreeable. Now that was charm. With English statesmen, it was always a question of asking something. Then there's no good being charming. The important thing was to say, we are in this position, we are suffering, persecution is going on, we need this, we need that. Can you do it? Why don't you do it?
Many either English, either wrote it or said it to me.
Many readers is for
charm.
Yes, they all said that. That's because the voice is beautiful. And he smiled, and obviously a kind of honeyed talk flowed. But it was not social talk of any kind. He was not one of them. He didn't pretend to be one of them.
No, I think that he pretended to be a statement, above there.
He was a representative of a government in exile. And although there was no government, he created the delusion, as if he had the people behind him.
You see, I remember, for example, somebody...
He was rather like Masaryk or something to them. Which is something which Sokolov never was.
Now, did he admire the aristocracy?
Yes. He thought they were elegant, decent people who were gentlemen and wouldn't do anything shabby or underhand. He did not trust civil servants. With the conservative aristocrats, he was all right. He never got on with the Labour Party.
Never. That was his personal tragedy, the Labour
never.
Aristocrats.
Never. He never knew them. He didn't know them. It didn't work. It didn't work for social reasons. There was an element of snobbery. There was. You see, all these friends of Israel, Ziv, all that, but never worked.
But Ziv and Marx had friends in the Labour.
Ziv particularly, because of PEP and
exactly.
All that.
That saved Weizmann in a way. That in a way, in 47, 48, it was the only contact he had.
Well, I imagine. I imagine so. He never, I don't know who he could have known in the Labour Party in the 30s or 20s. Who were they? I mean, Randall MacDonald, that is no good. Kleins, I mean.
Morrison visited Israel, in Palestine, in the 30s.
All right.
And as I said, Greenwood, after Greenwood.
The Lord Basfield, I mean, no. The webs, no good.
No.
Crips, no good.
Until 39, Malcolm McDonald.
Henderson. Henderson, not much good. He might have done business with Henderson. He was not impossible with Uncle, whatever he was called.
Maybe.
Arthur Henderson.
You know that in the 30s, betting was very strong.
I know. It appeared on Jewish platforms. I know. I don't quite know why he turned.
He turned because, I mean, it was just politically, I mean, he thought that
he could solve it.
That he may solve it.
And nothing happened to us.
And, I mean, he was a foreign secretary, and he had to take into account the Middle East, the Arab countries and everything. And, I mean, it was natural, I mean, and the bitterness that we managed to turn Truman and the Americans against him. He wouldn't forgive it. He was very pro-American.
He was?
Very pro-American.
I know. I mean, he had trouble with the Jews in New York.
And the fact that he was his main failure, he was in a way a politician that is not used to failures.
He was very, very vain. Enormously vain. Egomaniac.
And he was used to success.
And to people making up to him, to people flattering him and so on.
And he was admired by the foreign office.
He was admired by all conservatives.
Yes, and we were his main character.
That's correct.
And one, usually, when one of his character fails, he is looking for a scapegoat. He won't blame himself.
And that's how Mayhew became anti-Zionist.
Yes, but Mayhew is not a
man. But Mayhew had no particular sense of success or anything. It wasn't a personal failure. Just out of worship of Mayhew.
Now, and the scapegoat, we were not the scapegoat in Palestine, it's the Jews of New York.
I know.
That's the
big cigar-smoking millionaires who send people leaky ships.
Okay.
They don't go themselves. There's a lot of poor Jews. Poor Jews. The other thing about Bevin is this. I think he felt, like all people like him feel, he wanted to be, with the intellect, to some extent, power of the Labour Party. He wanted to be the Fabian side. He was, in some way, snubbed by Lasky.
Yes.
And his image of Zionist, to some extent, lead intellectuals anyway. He was like Khrushchev. He had an image of a lot of New York cigar-smoking rich Jews sending a lot of Leskis to Palestine where they deceived and cheated the Arabs. Because the Arabs were perfectly good schoolboys who occasionally rioted. The Jews were clever and cunning and intellectual, just the kind of people you couldn't get on with.
You know that Harold Billy was very candid in saying, you know, that Bevin was admired by the foreign office.
Then deeply.
And he said, and very candidly, that he was admired not because of his qualities, but because he was a strong minister. He was...
Did all they told you. Interfund defended them. He could carry anything in the cabinet.
And just see, I mean, if it was not...
No. He could carry anything in the cabinet.
That's what the
Philip Cousins
are like in the
no.
Now, I can...
George Brown, even.
Yes.
Terrible as he was.
Yes.
Conor Neal just died. Terrible. The great thing about George Brown, whom he loathed, was that if he said he'd get the cabinet to agree, he frightened them. They always tackled under.
Now, and with Bevin, it was even more so.
Quite. Because they actually loved him.
Now, I can tell you that in churches, in the warriors, Eden versus Oliver Stanley. Oliver Stanley was stronger than Eden in the cabinet.
I'm afraid to it.
He was colonial secretary.
Quite.
Now, in Attlee's cabinet, Bevin in front of Street Jones, I mean, he carried the...
No, but Attlee loved Bevin. And Bevin defended Attlee.
Yes.
When Morrison tried to get rid of Attlee,
okay.
Bevin wouldn't...
and Attlee knew.
I know he knew. Exactly. Great alliance. He used to call Attlee that nice little man. But certainly that's true. Yeah. Certainly.
But after 48, he was very busy.
Who? Really? When he ceased being foreign secretary?
He sent the first ambassador to Palestine, and his directive was very...
Eliash, of course, who got on very well with him. The first ambassador. Oh, yes.
And the ambassador who came to Israel, his directive was...
What's his name? He was a... What? The first ambassador, the man I knew in Washington.
In Israel?
Yes.
Noxhelm.
Noxhelm.
He was in Washington or he was in the American Department?
He was in the embassy. In Washington. He was a promoted consul. He was an Oriental... Ah, oh, that's my pupils. He was